We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined by my colleague, Christopher Bedford, senior editor at the Federalist. We are on scene at the National Conservative Conference down here in Miami. It's hosted by the Edmund Burke Foundation. Christopher, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
You're especially glad to be here because you now have a beer.
Yeah, I'm writing the minibar.
Yes. Yes. Well, Chris, I want to start just by asking your initial impressions. I was at the National Conservatism Conference last year. I think it was in Orlando. And, you know, it does attract a certain contingent of national journalists who are looking to sort of cover conservatives as gorillas in the mist and do their sort of Jane Goodall reporting on the on conservatism. And indeed, Jonathan Chait is here, and our boss, Sean Davis, called him out actually during his speech, basically told people not to talk to him, which is entirely wise guidance to provide to the audience. And so I expect there will be some Jane Goodall type reporting that comes after this, but it's very different than like a CPAC, even though it is, you know, has some of the usual trappings. In fact, all of the usual trappings, chicken dinners of your normal political conferences, but it's a little different than other conservative events. Chris, what's your impression been so far?
No, I think that's right. I was wondering what to expect, if this was going to be more like a CPAC, which is kind of a trade show, where a lot of folks, myself included, spend every hour after 11:30 at a sports bar or some other bar meeting with people.
You mean 11:30 a.m.?
Yes. It's lunchtime, appropriate time. And very few people listen to the speeches except for the activists, et cetera. This is not like that at all. It's pretty highly charged intellectual content. Which is great. It's really fast moving, which, I mean, I've appreciated. Some of the politicians have ignored this, but I was looking at the schedule, chuckling to myself and thinking, thank goodness, when I saw that they were only giving senators half an hour to speak. I thought that was excellent. Panels of four people are 1 hour. So while a lot of other traditional intellectual conferences have existed that have done great work, places like Philadelphia Society that will be very speaker heavy with a lot of folks in there, I generally think this is a lot less dry, a lot more interesting. The speaker's list reads like a list of Federalist contributors, essentially, and friends. People are, it's pretty rapid fire. And because of that, there's a lot of engagement. So usually, if you go to another, a lot of these conferences, you'll see the panels are largely empty. And usually the panels are discussing interesting ideas, but you're on a side stage. There might be six people and two of your friends in the room. Here, for the side panels, like your great one today, there's probably 200 plus people in that room. And it was pretty busy. And so there's an energy there. And it's folks who aren't just looking for normal Republican talking points at all. They're searching things out. So it's been interesting and good to see. In fact, I think even though it's 4 o'clock, like if I was at a normal conference right now, I'd be blasting off to find my friends. But after this podcast, I'm going to go back to check out the panels that are just beginning now.
A, I don't believe you. B, I think it's important to acknowledge that you went to the water park yesterday as a grown-ass man and went down the water slides.
That's true. There's a three-hour break, which I really appreciated because usually conferences are just nonstop going. And during that three-hour break, I went to the water park and it's kind of tough. I did the gayest thing I've ever done. I took a water slide with a grown man because you needed two people to do it. And Terry Schilling and I are looking at each other like,
Terry.
Like, oh my gosh, I guess we got to jump in. I mean, they're two-pod floats, but still, no photographic evidence. Also, it's not one of those normal water slides I remember from as a kid. It's terrifying. It's like a roller coaster. I recommend the Lazy River.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Well, Chris, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned it's like it's sort of like a Federalist reunion down here because Molly Hemingway, Sean Davis, you're down here, I'm down here, senior contributor Kelsey Bowler is down here, Inez Stepman's down here, Libby Emmons is down here. It's a lot of Federalist people down here for sure. Let's start with Rachel because Rachel's speech really is a good jumping off point, I think, to get into this broader conversation about what's happening down here. here in Miami. The press is going to try to figure out what's happening here in Miami and inevitably land upon some horrible explanation for how conservatism has gone wildly off the rails and is careening into just unspeakable territories. But Chris, when Rachel spoke, what do you think is the significance of what she had to say?
I liked that she told the room that as compared to previous years, they're no longer just small insurgents with ideas and that aren't being listened to. That they've been winning arguments. You hear now people like Marco Rubio, a Tea Party elected senator, which usually means he's never going to change. Most people, as Sean Davis always points out, most politicians wear the political moment of their first election for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. Well, he's down here talking about how we need to protect different industries. We need to bring things back. We need to – this free market stuff or free trade stuff is not always working, and there are certain things that are core to our country. You have Rick Scott coming down here and saying, I don't even want cheap plastic toys coming from China. I want nothing. And he gave a pretty general Republican speech. I saw Roger and other people were complaining about it, but I thought it was interesting, particularly in his harshness on China. You have Holly down here talking, who's always been kind of like more like this, talking about how our rights, not just saying the kind of classic Republican lines, but talking explicitly about how our rights can be found in Scripture and come from God. That shows, up to Rachel's point, that we're winning the arguments. But the thing is, winning the arguments is one thing. Winning elections is another thing.
I was going to say, are we winning if Mitch McConnell is still Senate majority leader if Republicans take the Senate and minority leader if they don't?
No, because there's still the arguments are one thing, but that doesn't mean they're winning the actual battle yet. And the GOP is still completely resistant. There are a number of elections that still need to come out. I actually saw it was interesting to see Heritage coming in with $5 million for Blake Masters while Peter Thiel and Mitch McConnell have their little slap fight in the corner over who wants to empty their pockets to actually have a Republican majority, the donor who backed Blake Masters or the Republican whose job it is to make sure there's a majority. I guess neither of them think it's their job.
Well, Thiel actually has an interesting argument that's relevant to all of this. He's reportedly concerned, and I think this was according to sources in the Washington Post, so who knows how true it is, that continued association with him, who is a tech mogul, would only be negative for Masters and for Vance. And that in and of itself is quite an interesting argument, because I think what it gets at is something, and it's something I wish maybe that there was a little bit more of here, the populist agenda. And I know this is about national conservatism, but it's very heavy on populism. And the populist agenda, I think, really is broadly palatable and appealing to people on the left as well. And what's interesting about Thiel not wanting to be associated with Masters or Vance for fear that it would hurt their campaigns is that there's anti-tech sentiment, for instance, on both the left and the right. And you see this in education as well.
Although this is one of the more anti-tech guys out there might be Peter Thiel, despite making all of his money from it. He's very suspicious of what's going on and very interesting on that. I understand his point. I understand his point more than I understand McConnell's point. But I think at the end of the day, both of them need to step up and actually back the candidates that they supposedly support so they can have a majority. But even then, it's still a matter of if you can govern that way. And if Mitch McConnell's majority leader, then they're not going to govern that way. It's kind of hard to see, though, how Mitch McConnell – I mean, it's actually easy to see how Mitch McConnell could hold on to power. But if he spends an entire cycle just dumping on the Republican candidates and the Republican candidates win despite him and Rick Scott's out there hammering away, then – I think Rick Scott might be able to actually take that mantle, potentially.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't actually see there being a path to anybody other than Mitch McConnell being majority or minority leader. But Chris, you've been sort of around these dynamics longer than I have in D.C. Truly, I don't see a path for anyone other than Kevin McCarthy or Mitch McConnell going forward in leadership if Republicans retake the House or retake the Senate. I just don't think that's going to happen. That leaves it with trying to persuade McCarthy and McConnell to govern more responsibly. But the more responsibly here is a total overhaul. It would require basically scorched earth on the Republican Party, at least in my opinion. And that seems to be a massive roadblock.
I think Kevin McCarthy is going to, he's a go-along guy. He's going to go at the moment.
I shouldn't have said Kevin McCarthy. I guess I mean Mitch McConnell. I'm not worried about really McCarthy on that front.
Yeah, McConnell's going to block. McConnell's going to continue to do what McConnell's always done, which is whatever McConnell wants, regardless of what the party thinks, the base thinks, or anyone else. I don't have particularly high hopes so you can be replaced, but there's actually a good and sound candidate to replace him that we have now in Rick Scott, somebody who actually raises money for people, who does coalitions, who's got friends, who is a serious player. That's not to say that he's conservative or he's the most populist guy out there. He's certainly not. But I think he's more of a doer, and he's sick of the inaction that he feels is coming from Republican leadership. One interesting thing I've noticed about this conference, which kind of surprises me, is, well, a lot of our panelists have been talking about abortion and how disappointed it is Republicans are unable to even really speak about that and are running from it, while the liberal media claims that they're winning. And Republicans don't even know how to talk about life. They seem to stumble over themselves when the vote was just pushed. Or not life, a marriage. Mm-hmm. They stumble over themselves when the vote was just pushed. Republicans didn't even realize that their base was still pro-marriage, straight marriage, between a man and a woman. There's very little donated to that. There's a lot given to Christians, a lot given to Catholics. There's a really outsized level of attention being paid to integralists. Is the threat to the social conservatives, the national conservatives, integralists, or is it Republicans who want to betray biblical values because the times have changed? They don't want to make the argument. Mm. I would say it's more the latter than the former.
Well, this is an interesting question because it's one thing I enjoy about this conference compared to some others is that I feel like it's removed from the fray of the daily news cycle. It's not infected by the chaos of daily politics. And I think that's kind of helpful to have these transcendent conversations about bigger picture issues because, again, like that's where the Republican Party basically needs scorched earth overhaul. Like it just completely needs something different. But the challenge then, it's something like at the Federalist, for instance, how many news publications that have the I guess political cash that we do have a politics editor that lives in Austin, Texas, that have a managing editor based in Dallas, an executive editor based in Fort Wayne. The team's not in D.C., and a lot of us have been in D.C., which is helpful. But that's the sort of challenge, I think, going forward is translating these big ideas into political victories.
Who's in Dallas?
Madeline.
Madeline lives in Dallas? I had no idea. I'm sorry. She's never invited me over.
I guess I shouldn't. I'm just going to dox her and give her full address. but no, I think that is the real challenge also, Chris, this is even worse because I said our managing editor lives in Dallas. So you don't even, not only do you not know that Madeline lives in Dallas, you don't even know that she does.
I've known since I got here that Madeline does important things all the time, despite what you say.
And she, yes, right. But all that is to say, translating this very, very different energy and these very new ideas into political power, I think obviously is going to take time. And that's been in motion really since 2015 in different ways, since Donald Trump announced his candidacy. But translating this into political power, Chris, where does that go from here? You know, we have the McConnell point is a really interesting one. But let's say, you know, which is almost certain to happen. Let's say Mitch McConnell is leader, whether it's majority or minority. But let's just say he's majority leader. Let's say there's a slim margin in both the House and the Senate. And let's keep up with the thought experiment. And let's say there's a Republican president in office. How do you get Mitch McConnell to do something that's not tax cuts?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see who the Republican president is. I mean, I don't think a President Donald Trump would be supportive of Mitch McConnell, but in order for Donald Trump to have any sway at all over the Senate, he has to use some of the goblin gold that he's hoarded up and actually send it out to people. he has to imagine if he'd come in and said, here's $5 million to back Blake Masters. That would have been interesting. I understand that he doesn't really want to play in this race, that he raised that money for his own presidential ambitions. But if he wants to have an impact on who is the majority leader in the Senate, then he's got to have money. All of this is about money.
Because he hasn't been afraid to make endorsements.
Yeah, that's true. And endorsements are cheap.
But it's different, yeah.
It's different. At the end of the day, if Donald Trump's going to fly in and do some rallies for you, that's good. You know, you don't want him against you. You want him for you, in general, if you're a Republican candidate. But if all of your money comes from Mitch McConnell in the Senate leadership and then your own fundraising, then you don't vote against them for backbenchers who haven't ever given you money. You don't vote against them just because of a couple endorsement. You need to work with your party. If Mitch McConnell controls that money and a lot of the consultants that are around it too. So it'll be, I guess, kind of wild to see how that plays out. I'm also curious how the future of NatCon, this is the biggest one yet. I think it's been a success. People are really enjoying it. A lot of the things that they started talking about and other things that we've been talking about at the Federalist for years are taking effect, and they're kind of more taken for granted than they used to be. They were completely heterodox. They were basically heresy when we first started saying them against Reagan zombieism, and now that's moved on. But I'm interested to see if these are discussions, these things that they're having right now, like the conference I'm going to go to after this podcast is about Catholicism and nationalism and how that fits with Emil from the American Conservative and Matt Peterson on that panel and some others. I'm interested to see if these kind of arguments, these disagreements between people are talked about, worked out in a respectful and interesting place. It's got a lot of different ideas. The kind of thing that shows that there's actually intellectual life and a pulse in this movement, or are people, is there kind of like this constant attacking of the integralists and things like that? Is that a sign that this is going to devolve into just more partisan bickering over ideas that Americans don't really care about?
They really, really, really don't.
We haven't even, you could look at the speakers. No one's even figured out if it's integralist or integralist. I hadn't thought about it. I've always called it integralism. It's just the idea that, and for those people out there who have no idea what it is, good for you.
Everyone, yeah. First of all, congratulations.
It's an idea that the American Constitution is wrong in its framing. The liberal idea is wrong in its framing because Catholicism and the old models of church and state, one together with a moral understanding of the law backed in scripture, is the proper way to make, the only way to stop society from careening into a self-indulgent decay in liberal materialism. I heard an argument yesterday from like an otherwise really smart person, who actually did a really good job, Kevin Roberts, president of the Heritage Foundation, shared a little bit of his background, growing up poor in Louisiana. Divorce very young, drug addiction in the family, this awful story of his teenage brother committing suicide when he was just 9 years old. I can't imagine what a nine-year-old, how do you tell a nine-year-old's brother's not there anymore? Like, and doing Buchanan rallies when he was young and knowing what time it was, as he said back then, which I think was a good thing for him to do, to come into a place that's suspicious of places like Heritage and say, listen, here, let me lay myself bare. But he had this argument at the end about, I guess he felt like as a Catholic, as a former head of a Catholic university, he had to talk about the integralists. And he said that their ideas don't work with Christian ideas of salvation. And I was just thinking, well, explain that to 1,000 years of Christendom, because I don't think the American experiment overrides those ideas. But so I'm interested to see if this devolves into some kind of partisan stuff or if we keep on coming up with really good ideas.
Well, that's kind of exactly where I wanted to go with the conversation, because Inez Stepman of the Independent Women's Forum and a senior Federalist contributor, we were talking at lunch, and Inez was she said this in passing, made a comment about how integralism, what they identify as a problem with the American founding, is really a problem of modernity. And that's what I talked about in my remarks on a culture and media panel, because I was at this last year and on a culture and media panel, and there's so much important stuff to say about culture and media. We could talk about cancel culture. We could talk about media corruption. These are all really important. But I also think it's helpful to start reframing this conversation as one. All of these problems, they're not not all without precedent, but a lot of them are uniquely consequences of modernity and hypernovelty and all of these problems that
wealth.
Exactly, material wealth and prosperity, the likes of which humanity has never, ever seen. Someone asked a question in our panel about abolishing the Department of Education. You know, what does the off-ramp look like for a Department of Education? And as the question was being asked, I was like, well, we couldn't have a federal Department of Education that is in control of this vast system of public and private schools without technology, right? Like, technology is the reason that our bureaucracy has ballooned and inflated to the point where you have bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. in control of the minutiae of daily life in different corners of this like insanely vast swath of land like the United States. It's not normal. It's not how we're meant to govern each other. It's not how we're meant to relate with each other. And I guess, Chris, what I want you to do is throw cold water on what I said, because it seems to me it's almost like there's no way to put the genie back in the bottle. And I'm not saying that I'm not going full Unabomber here, as I sometimes like to joke. But I do think our politics needs to be completely recentered around the concept of, and the Republican Party needs to, and that's why some of the ideas that I put forward, it's like banning porn, investigating Coca-Cola, putting outdoor public gyms in local parks, free outdoor, like these are things that local Republicans can do. They can beautify their neighborhoods and suburbs. It doesn't take federal Republicans to do all of this. We should ban TikTok. We should start seriously curtailing the problem of social media and addictive social media. We should start treating food in, a very particular way. We should start making sure that workspaces allow for physical motion that makes us happy and not depressed and anxious and all of those different things. But we don't have a lot of these conversations that actually need to be happening in the political context at all. And I guess I'm pessimistic that we can.
I loved your speech for that reason, talking about those things. And just, I think it was you or it might have been another speaker you teed off against who brought up the idea that the internet and screen life and social media life and pornography can offer you enough. It might have been Dave Riobi.
No, this was a quote that I had from Barry Weiss's newsletter. It was the most depressing thing I've ever heard. It was a 26-year-old guy who lives outside London saying, I assume that real life isn't as good as pornography and social media, that like actual sex and actual social interaction is better. But this is fine.
It's enough to get by. It's kind of like it's just a soft tyranny, or just a that's kind of what we're fighting against. And Republicans, I think that you had some good points about and Azarad made some points previously about how we're both the most overweight nation, and at the same time we consume the most pornography. Mm. Well, those are two food and sex are two very basic animal appetites. Mm-hmm. That the United States has. And we are going off on how porn is normal and sex work is normal and these things should be destigmatized. And at the same time, we're going with these body positivity and things like that. But neither of those things lead to real happiness. I mean, often those things subtract from happiness. And we should be willing to talk about those sorts of things and say, listen, are we happy? I mean, a lot of people who have a lot of weight aren't even eating well. It's not like they're King Richard out there just crushing lamb and beef every single day. They're eating garbage. It's like not even fulfilling. Republicans actually talking about those things. Tucker's been talking about it. Roger Scruton used to talk about it. Common Sense Society talks about it. The idea that we need to push beauty back into the equation. One of the last things that Donald Trump did in office was sign the Make American Buildings Beautiful Again Act that would force federal architecture to go within the constraints of the very broad and easy to move constraints of traditional architecture and not do ugly things that people hate, like they so often love to do, like brutalism, et cetera. And that was one of the first things that Biden repealed. And then Biden stripped out a lot of the great minds from the committees that approve federal architecture and replace them with some of his just liberal modernist sycophants that are completely aligned against the American people. Why would that be one of his early goals? That's wild that people had that just right in their targets, and it's something that the American people are very much against. The American people don't like ugly buildings. You don't need to have
shipping container Arby's. Those are my favorite.
Yeah, you don't need a master's or a doctorate in philosophy to understand when you see something ugly that is ugly. That's one of the things that makes civic architecture so important and so beautiful. You don't need to get to have a doctorate in health or be a health worker of some kind in order to understand that being overweight is unhealthy, uncomfortable, and deadly. You don't need nowadays, people are starting to finally realize the way that even liberals of all different stripes are realizing that the dangers of pornography are not simply in the human trafficking aspects. It's not simply in the victimization of the actors and the actresses that goes on there and in the violent lifestyle that it promotes, but it affects your brain. It affects your drive, and it affects the endorphin releases in your brain, what your brain associates with those specific releases, to a point that it's going, even if you're happily married and you watch it every now and then, it'll change what you think is normal. It'll change what your brain is aroused by, and that will impact your relationship. It'll impact your marriage. It'll impact your dating life, etc. It gives you a warped idea. It changes your brain chemically, and people need to start talking about that. And those kind of things are huge sources of our unhappiness. And just like you said, huge sources of the unhappiness that leads in the malaise that leads to, well, geez, people dying earlier than they used to in 2014.
It's insane. Yeah, the life expectancy was on the rise every year until 2014. Basically, that's the trend. When Queen Elizabeth was born in 1926, the average American woman lived to be just 58. It's incredible what happened in such a short period of time. And I started my remarks by saying, could you explain what happened on 9/11/2001 to somebody on 9/11/1901? No, you could not explain a 1,400-foot skyscraper in the air or commercial jet. I mean, it would be inconceivable. There would be no frame of reference. And that has affected our politics for years, of course. And it's, you know, maybe in the short time we have remaining, Chris, I'll pose a question to you that I was thinking about is, you know, why has there not been a Ralph Nader candidate yet for tech? You know, like it's kind of incredible to me that we've transferred our political, personal, professional lives onto this virtual infrastructure that is now inescapable, to the point if you want to keep your kid off of porn, as parents know, you have to remove them from that almost entirely, some way, somehow. And even then, there's no guarantee.
Like why aren't they 18 plus for smartphones?
It's crazy.
At least 16 plus for smartphones. You shouldn't. I mean, it's a battle between parents, I'm sure, all over, and schools. I mean, I really, really, really like the school that Reeve enrolled our boy in, but they offered an iPad that was free from Apple. It's like, no, I'm not going to give a first grader an iPad. Are you out of your mind? No, face your desk toward the chalkboard and learn. Here's a pen, here's some paper, here's a crayon. Go.
Yeah, but there's a Glenn Youngkin executive order right there. No iPads in public schools in Virginia, period. Right? Like, and this is not in the political context at all. We do not talk about it. We're talking about difficult things. We're talking about antitrust. We're talking about China. We're talking about, you know, breaking up social media. We're talking about family formation and child tax credits. I guess you do risk sounding naive when you say all these things.
No, just hold them to account for their promises. Remember when the iPhone and the iPad and the computer were early in, I guess you probably don't as much as I do. The iPhone came out when I was a senior in college. This stuff comes out and there's all these promises of how it's going to unlock education, about how finally, you know, poor kids and underserved neighborhoods are going to be able to have access to great educational materials. Well, okay, cool. Have their test scores gone up?
Why are schools still taking Apple's free money for iPads for children, for 8-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 7-year-olds?
They're addictive. They completely destroy attention spans. They give access to all kinds of evil through the internet. I mean, if you want to search for it, you can find awful, awful things on the internet. And people do. Okay, so let's hold them to account. This is supposed to unlock everyone's capability, the children's capability. Are children testing better? Are they showing more promise? Are testing scores going up? Are dropouts going down? No. No, all the trends are going significantly more negatively. I think in England, where they had a 2-year break from the tests that everyone has to take because of COVID, they thought it would be really unfair to do these tests after kids had had their education disrupted. So they told everyone what was going to be on the test ahead of time. You only had to get, I think it was like 13%. I'm going to screw up these numbers. Like 13% correct in math in order to get a passing grade. And over 40% of the country failed. That means, and they're just going to say, well, we failed them. It's like, listen, these kids, you're putting out imbeciles. You're putting out people who are incapable of getting 13% on a national basic math thing, despite all the iPads, despite all the computers, despite all the home learning. You're putting out a stupid generation. And stupid parents don't go home and read to their children at night. Stupid parents don't sit down and do their homework, typically. I mean, I'm sure some do who are like hardworking and understand it, but this is going to be generational impact. And you're right. We need candidates out there who are just going to look at tech and say, here's what it promised. Let's rewind a minute and say, here are all the big promises of big tech. Has much of that really been delivered, or have we just looked at it and we said, no, we need it. We need our dopamine hit. I get my buzzes. I need my buzzes.
We need to fundraise off Twitter or Facebook or whatever it is. Well, and so, Chris, this is a good place. I know you have to get to your the panel that you're looking forward to, this is a good place to maybe just bring it full circle with one more question and think about, you know, what you said, that it used to be heresy to talk about zombie Reaganism, and now you have Bovard on stage with a just total barn burner, and you have...
2 years in a row.
Oh, yeah.
She's got a lot to keep up now. She's going to go for that hat trick.
Good luck, Rachel. But you have politicians who are seen as like fairly establishment mainstream Republicans, like Rick Scott here at NatCon, giving his own sort of barn burner, whatever people thought of it. Like the fact that he said, I don't even want cheap Chinese toys. I mean, this is just the Overton window on the right has clearly shifted. This conference is good evidence of it. Marco Rubio, as you mentioned, and then you have people like Josh Hawley and Blake Masters and Ron DeSantis here making these points. And the Overton window has clearly shifted in terms of how we talk about the media. It's clearly shifted in terms of how we talk about antitrust, how we talk about tech, how we talk about X, Y, and Z. And yet, we're still not talking about what you just mentioned, our like the addictiveness of tech, the poison of tech. We're not talking about beauty. We're not talking about obesity. We're not talking about any of this stuff in a political context at all. Glossy magazines continue to feature obesity as a virtue and as a beauty. They continue to, or as a pinnacle of beauty, I should say. And it feels like the Overton window can shift on the right. But actual progress in a good direction, I still feel pessimistic about. I don't see how it translates.
I mean, I'm more optimistic today than normally because I think that these are all important things that people weren't even talking about a few years ago. And we don't know how it's going to go yet because we've only just now begun to fight.
Christopher Bedford, I defer to your wisdom and I defer to your schedule. Chris Bedford, Senior Editor of The Federalist, thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
Of course, I'm Emily Jashinsky, Culture Editor here at The Federalist. You have been listening to another edition of Federalist Radio Hour on scene at the National Conservatism Conference in Miami. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.